segment, Farrah and I are going to go over the concept of tropes. It's a word we use a lot, but we realize that unpacking what a trope actually is and what it isn't, and maybe be helpful to some of you. Plus, we just really love talking about them, so this is a little bit self-indulgent. The standard definition of a trope that I always think of really is that they're shorthand. It's a literary device that is used so often that everyone kind of knows what they're getting into. They can be themes, stereotypes, settings, ideas. As far as I am concerned, and from the definitions that I've seen around and the way other people seem to use it, the only real boundary on a trope is that it's recognizable. It is a kind of a set thing. You can play with it. We'll talk about that later. You can subvert it. You can do all of those things. But on some level, it happens enough times that it is set and recognizable. Now, trope and cliche are sometimes used interchangeably. I don't think they are interchangeable, but let me explain why. So a trope that has been used to death that people kind of roll their eyes at, some of the ones that get really into stereotypes in particular, I think lean into cliche. Now, the boundary between those is personal opinion. There are times that even Farrah and I have had conversations, and something that I think of as a trope, she thinks of as a cliche, and vice versa. This is very, very flexible definitions in between them. The stuff that I think of as cliche in perhaps science fiction or fantasy is stuff that other people may think of as beloved tropes. So some of this, by the way, the difference in how you interact with tropes depends on the kind of medium they are in. There are lots and lots and lots of romance tropes that people who don't read romance think of as completely cliche. That those of us who read romance and write it think of it as basic building blocks. Mr. Flame thinks fake dating is so cliche. I think it is the greatest things literature has ever given to us. So it's your mileage may vary on this, but I do not think they are, as a literary term, interchangeable. They might be personally interchangeable, but I don't think literarily that they are.
Bouncing off of that as well, cliche is a word that has a negative connotation to it and implies that something is bad or unliked or shouldn't be used in some way. Whereas the concept of a trope is value neutral. So in some ways, calling something a cliche is adding a negative connotation to a known trope. A lot of people seem to think that the concept of a trope does carry an inherent negative connotation, but they simply can't. As a concept, tropes in general can't be a negative thing to have a trope in a story, because every single story can be broken down into tropes. They are the necessary building blocks of stories because they're based on the fundamentals of storytelling, the fundamentals of how characters, how people are built, and the lack of variety that is in the way the world works.
And I think sometimes people think that you can tell stories with, like, that using a trope is lazy somehow. I feel like I hear this from especially like dude bros. You can't tell a story without tropes. You just can't.
Yeah, they're literally just the discussion of what is a trope is the discussion of the Lego blocks that build stories. And the goal of breaking things down into tropes is to bring things down to their very core essences. So while an individual trope could be one you don't like, or one you think is cliche, or even one that the vast majority of people think is cliche, or one that's stereotypical or harmful, those can be negative in that way. But merely containing tropes or a thing being a trope cannot mean that it is bad. It just means that it is a building block of storytelling. Sometimes we use the adjective tropey in fan fiction. Something's very tropey. And I don't think that in fanfic that has necessarily a negative connotation, but it does generally mean that something is predictable or safe, or that the story is smushed full of lots of the most popular or common tropes or patterns that we're used to seeing. For some people, that's a good thing. For some people, that's a bad thing. So I think that as we're talking about tropes and thinking about tropes when we're writing, we should also be careful to recognize that inherently tropes are not a bad thing. They are a necessary thing. And any discussions about value are about either specific tropes or the way tropes are being used or how you're engaging your readers or any of those sorts of things. Speaking of breaking things down into the Lego blocks, I kind of wanted to introduce, some of you might not know about the project TVTropes.org. It's been around, God, I don't even know when it started, but a long time ago. And it's a website with the goal of identifying and naming and building reference lists for every trope that they can find. So any recognizable pattern, character, story beat, all of these things are broken down on TV Tropes. And it's huge. And it's a wiki style structure. So you can get lost in it for years because every trope links to other related tropes. Every trope has a complete list under it of every reference in anime, TV, movies, books, everything. They have categories for all of them. And some of them have been submitted. Some of them, you know, the people who are collaborating on this project submit them, but users submit them too. And it's kind of endless. And I've spent years and years and years of my life just clicking through TV Tropes. It's really fun and I recommend it. And just to give you sort of a taste of what it's like, I just wanted to share with you three tropes and how they describe them on TV Tropes that I think will be familiar for you possibly, that are very well known, but they also have hundreds and thousands of other tropes that maybe you've never heard of because you're not in that genre at all. The first one is lampshading. It's actually officially called lampshade hanging. And this is what TV Tropes has to say. Lampshading is the writer's trick of dealing with any element of the story that threatens the audience's willing suspension of disbelief, whether a very implausible plot development or a particularly blatant use of a trope, by calling attention to it and simply moving on. This assures the audience that the author is aware of the implausible plot device that just happened and that they aren't trying to slip something past the audience. It also assures the audience that the world of the story is like real life. What's implausible for you or me is just as implausible for these characters and just as likely to provoke an incredulous response. I think fanfic has a lot of built-in lampshading because sometimes we're hanging a lampshade on the ways that we know canon did or didn't work.
Yep.
And so that can be fun. But also sometimes, you know, you can just say, yeah, there's a plot hole and I'm just going to show everybody that I know it's there and we're going to move on from it. So I think lampshading is one of the best, one of my favorites.
It's fun to play with too. Like I literally just did it in a fic when I realized that I had used two different ways to spell this one thing. So I just went ahead and had a character point that out and be like, so which one is it? We keep seeing it different ways.
That's good.
Cause I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. And I didn't keep track of this. And that was absolutely how I lampshaded that because it felt better to call it out and spotlight it than to let someone think I hadn't paid attention to what was going on, even though that was
It also like calls back to the like, even if there's no lampshade hung on it, if you're a reader, I like to give authors the benefit of the doubt and assume that they noticed and they just didn't care to change it. So hang your own lampshade sometimes and it lets you enjoy things a little bit more.
Yep.
Next up, we have a very special episode.
My all personal capitals, favorite.
Which, one of Flame's favorites. This maybe doesn't fit so much with fanfic, but... if you watched any like sitcoms in the 90s, you've got a lot of these. So a very special episode is an episode, often in a sitcom, in which the lead confronts some highly emotional or forbidden issue from everyday life. Drug abuse, eating disorders, and worse, teenagers having sex. At the end of the episode, the protagonist is enlightened and the guest character with the very special problem is never seen or heard from again. Often there's a 900 number or an 800 number to call should you or someone you love actually have the very special problem.
I snort a little because a 900 number in America was a sex line.
Yeah, I think it was here too. I don't know why that came out of my mouth.
That's a really fun Freudian slip. But also, can I tell you I have two very like special favorite episodes. Can I just say them really quick?
Yeah.
They're both from Saved by the Bell. And classic. One of them is the very famous Jesse Spano takes speed to pass the SATs one.
Okay.
Which is a slight inversion in that, like, I mean, Jesse was a main character, but it was still a super special episode because we had to talk about how your grades were not more important than your health, even though everything else in American culture told us otherwise, but whatever, drugs are not worth it.
Right. And then the other one, it never comes up again, right? It's just like the one
ever. No.
Episode.
It's, yeah. She's so excited and she's so scared and that's it. And then the other one is also to do with drugs, in which there was a new boy in school who, yeah, I know. And he was dangerous. He wore flannel and leather jackets.
Shocking.
I mean, clutch your pearls. I believe his name was Johnny.
Of course it was.
And they all called him out and it was a whole thing. And then at the end of the episode, literally the president of NBC, Brandon Tartikoff, somehow shows up at Bayside High School and they shoot a PSA.
Oh my God.
That finishes with, "There's no hope with dope."
That's fantastic.
It was the most peak 90s, like, oh my gosh. And then we can get into, there's dramas too, like ER had a very famous one called Love's Labor Lost. That's a very special episode about like women dying, about preeclampsia and women dying in childbirth. Like,
oh, yeah.
Dramas do this too, but it is so blatant in sitcoms that's.
Especially sitcoms aimed towards teenagers, because this was very much like a tool for using TV to like raise our kids right kind of thing. So
yeah.
Like, I feel like Degrassi was just laden. Like, maybe every episode was a very special episode.
Oh, I just assumed that all of Degrassi like was a very special series.
Yeah, probably. And then
like every episode I've ever seen is.
If anyone's seen Clone High, which I just...
Oh my God.
At the beginning of every episode, the narrator says, "Tonight on a very special episode of Clone High." And that's absolutely a callback to this very trope. So if you've enjoyed
that,
that's where it comes from. Our last fave trope from TV Tropes is one that absolutely is a big deal in fan fiction and probably a great thing for us all to be thinking about sometimes. And that is Chekhov's gun. You might have heard of this before, but not actually entirely know what it means. Chekhov was a writer, master of the short story. And here's what TV Tropes has to say, that he gave this advice: if it's not essential, don't include it in the story. The term has come to mean an insignificant object that later turns out to be important. For example, a character may find a mysterious necklace that turns out to be the power source to the doomsday device, but at the time of finding the object, it does not seem important. The necklace was essential to the story, but its introduction downplayed its importance. Chekhov's advice was not necessarily to conceal importance, but to just not spend time on things that are not important. A lot of people consider the phrase "Chekhov's gun" synonymous with foreshadowing. They are related. A gun that goes off in the third act that hasn't been seen in the play at all before then is going to feel like a real asshole, which is another TV trope. But that's not key to the meaning of the phrase. So while the gun itself as a concept is telling you if you're going to need the necklace later, introduce it at the beginning, it also tells you don't introduce the necklace and make a big deal out of it if it's not going to come back later in the story. So there are kind of two sides to taking Chekhov's gun trope as real advice for when you're plotting out your stories.
Yeah, because the gun thing is from a play he wrote where they literally had a gun mounted on a wall in act one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just there for act one and act two. And you didn't really, like, I think a character comments on it, like says something like, "That's a really nice gun." And there's a little bit of a, but it's just the decor. And then it is a pivotal part of an act in act three where somebody grabs it off the wall and is able to use it in a very significant way. Because in that particular play, it's the only way to get this thing happening. So but it's foreshadowing without like announcing anything. The not announcing anything, to reiterate again, like Farrah just said, is the important thing. And I will be honest, this is one of those ones that I wish more of us would be careful with in fanfic. I can't lie.
Yeah, it is the kind of thing where you notice when it hasn't been done right. And sometimes you don't notice when it has been done right because it's so smooth. But I think we have a whole potential episode on foreshadowing that we could go into this more, because it is something that takes some active thought. And I think a lot of writers struggle with it. It takes a lot of practice. I struggle with it. So we'll get into that more. And if you guys want to hear more about that, let us know so that we know to make it a priority for upcoming episodes. But moving off of TV tropes, which I love, and we will obviously link it in the show notes and you guys should totally check it out, but maybe like only on a holiday or a weekend because you might lose a few hours clicking around. But in a way, the AO3 tag system kind of draws from the same concept that we can use certain turns of phrase to embody these whole concepts that will be recognizable to people. And so things like when we have fake dating or ABO or hurt comfort as tags on AO3, they're doing the same kind of thing where they're identifying a trope or a suite of tropes that you can expect to find in the story. And this is definitely like a concept that has grown over time as fandom and media analysis and media consumption has become a public entity on the internet, a shared public entity. We've drawn these shorthand ways of talking about not just the events in the canon that we love, like all the short forms we use for the various movies and stuff like that, but the very building blocks that make up the stories that we love.
There are tropes that are really comfortable. Like, I have base expectations going into the work, a fic, a movie, a video game, a novel. Like, as we talk in the next section about expectation versus surprise, and the tags and how this all relates, we'll get into this a little bit more. But fundamentally, that's what the building blocks of a story mean. A certain trope is comfortable for certain people. And we generally know what things are going to happen when you go into, for instance, let me talk about the tropes that are innate within a rom-com. When you call something a rom-com, some things are going to happen. There's going to be a misunderstanding. Two protagonists that will have some reason that they're not already together, but they'll overcome it in the story. There's frequently a sassy best friend. There is often a wise parent, an adorable moppet. They help provide clarity to the characters on their journey to love. Then comes the moment where the protagonists realize that they only have a happily ever after together and everything ends well. And it's having story beats that you can trust. We all have our favorites and we have ones that don't work for us. As you all know, and this is no secret, I spend most of my time in romance literature and romance movies. We've talked a lot about my love of Hallmark movies and the holiday movies and the beats they move by. I understand that for a lot of people, the tropes of romance are why they don't engage with it. They don't want happily after afters. They don't want two or three protagonists that work things out together. They want different things. They want different tropes. And so they go to other genres. If you want a trope that involves, I don't read science fiction or fantasy all that often, and I don't really watch action movies that don't involve Tony Stark. So I'm not super helpful here, but if you want a trope of a good guy literally physically beating the living shit out of a bad guy, you're probably not going to find that in a rom-com. So you're going to go somewhere else. The horror tropes, the virgin sacrifice, the don't going down the stairs, the all of that, those exist in thrillers and suspense. And so you know what's going in a very, very specific way that a lot of us find comforting significantly more often than we emotionally investigate. I absolutely adore friends to lovers as a trope. I have for all of my reading life. I love arranged marriage. I loved fake dating. I love forced proximity. And I have a real thing for single parents. Some of those have shifted throughout my life, by the way. I'm not a huge fuck or die fan. I generally don't love mortal peril mixed in with my fiction unless I'm going in to read a thriller. If I find mortal peril in something that I think of as a romance, I'm usually thrown off and I don't care for it. I hate cliffhangers almost more than anything else. And so anything I read, and this is, I've talked to people who have been helping me find comics, like Key and Magic have been guiding me through my comics journey. And the real important thing I keep stressing to them is I'll read just about anything as long as I know the story is going to end. Like, I need a beginning, a middle, and an end.
It can be hard to find in comics.
In comics,
they
want
to keep you coming back week to week. So keep you on.
God love them. They're being very, so I started with Man Out of Time, for instance. And yeah. I'm just finished Extremis. And those are kind of set stories that really help me. As I read more comics, I might be significantly more comfortable with open and maybe I'll get there. I don't know. But in my life, it's like one of the reasons I tend to not read giant fantasy series. Because in romance series, even if they are sprawling, like the very famous right now, Bridgerton series is 8 books, four prequels and four sequels. They're massive. You can read absolutely every single one of those books on their own and never touch another one. They are self-contained stories in a wider world. And that's what I'm used to. I started reading romance when I was 11. So that's just kind of how I cut my teeth on literature. And it's what I really like. So that's kind of mine. I've gone through phases where I really, really like the secret baby thing that happens a lot in Harlequin novels. And I've gone through phases where I absolutely will not read it if it's in it. So there's tropes of mine that my tastes change, but I will tell you right now, friends to lovers, fake dating, like those are my, mwah. They are the all the time, no matter what, I will love these things.
I dislike cliffhangers too. I think it's because endings, or at least the moment right before the ending, is usually my favorite part of a story. So if I feel like I'm building up to my favorite part and it doesn't come, that's really brutal for me. So I'm not someone who can really read whips. But unlike Flame, I do like a little mortal peril in my stories, because I think I've said this 5 million times that hurt, comfort, and angst with a happy ending are my favorite places to live. I want something that hurts so bad and then feels so good at the end. And while I do indulge in some fluff and stuff like that, I really like something that's got, there's got to be a struggle in the middle for it to be one of my peak faves. But yeah, I could drool on that all day long.
What's really funny is that I like it a whole lot better in fic than I do in like published works.
Yeah. And I think that, there's a whole other episode there too, about the difference between fics and published works, and that we get a lot of, our safety in other ways from fics that we don't have in published works. So we need to feel safer in different ways when we read published works.
Another one that you guys would like us to explore, please let us know.
At the end of the day, when you're thinking about tropes, I think maybe the best way to consider it is, tropes are all the little Lego bricks. And we've been talking about Lego a lot on this podcast. I don't think that's going to stick around, but we've just got some Lego episodes back to back. And I'm sorry for that, but y'all like Lego, right? So imagine all the little Lego bricks. Each one is a different trope. They're different shapes or different colors. Genres are like the bins you sort the Legos in. So you'll have a romance bin and it's got all the tropes in it that can build or be expected in a romance novel. You've got your horror bin. Sometimes bins have the same Lego bricks in them, sometimes they don't. And when you build a story, you're dipping into the bins to construct something. And they could all be from one bin. You can do cross-genre stuff for multiple bins. And we're going to talk a lot in the next segment about picking those blocks and sticking them together. But just to sort of conceptualize the relationship between tropes and genres and stories, that's what you're looking at. And a cliche is the brick that got left out overnight and you stepped on it in the morning. And we all know how it feels to step on a Lego brick when you weren't expecting it. So there you go.